This is Class 10 of An Introduction to the Essential Teachings of Trungpa Rinpoche. These talks were given at the Boulder Shambhala Center in the fall of 2009. The presenter of this evening's talk, titled Sacred World, is Robert Spellman. The date is December 8th.
I just crawled out of bed after 4 days of an astonishing cold. So, I'm not sure what's going to happen. But I would like to thank Clark and Peter Voltz also for organizing this series of classes and for inviting me to come and say something. I thought I'd say a little bit about my own history with Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, since this is a class about his instructions and students and so on. That I was thinking about last week when Sherab Chudzin was talking, and he was talking about the very early, almost moments, you could say, of Chögyam Trungpa's arrival in North America. I realized when I went home that I actually arrived somewhat after the Big Bang, so to speak. When they talk about the beginning of the universe and there was a Big Bang, supposedly. Does anybody really believe this? I mean, I don't know. There's nothing to refute it, but it's a kind of a strange story. But they talk about the Big Bang and that seconds after the Big Bang, there were already like trillions of miles between things, and, there was a lot going on. So people who came along after the Big Bang were somewhat part of the space rubble, you could say. And I think that probably a lot of the people in the generation that I'm part of who refer to themselves as students of Chögyam Trungpa are in a similar category of not having necessarily been right in an inner circle and in a personal relationship with him, but encountered, you could almost say, what the universe that he was well underway in creating. And in some ways, my first encounter with Chögyam Trungpa was much more with what he had created, what he was in the process of creating, than with him personally. I was in Boston, Massachusetts, and there was a well-established meditation center there that he had founded, and the people who were teaching there were quite good. And I received meditation instruction, and we listened to tapes of the Vidyadhara, but actually did not meet him for about a year after that. So I think in some ways it's useful to talk about this aspect of what he was doing, because what he set in motion is, this very room that we're sitting in, the building, Naropa University, and all of the different centers that his son is now running. That was a very powerful structure that he was had put in place, and it had very specific attributes. And some of those I'd like to talk about. The topic of this evening's, whatever this is, it's not really a lecture, I don't think, is Sacred World. And there are so many different ways of talking about this that I thought of a few, and I'll try to weave those together in something that I hope is comprehensible. One of the interesting things about a lot of cultural artifacts, and this seems to be universal, is that the things that a culture creates contain the wisdom of the culture. I was interested to read that in Navajo rugs, for example, you can picture them, the very strong diagonal patterns and so on. They're very simple and very beautiful, and very varied, and apparently contain tremendous cultural instruction. They're imbued or woven right into the colors, and the pattern in the rug itself is information, which, if you're part of that culture, is completely apparent or at least available. And along these lines, one of the things about Chögyam Trungpa that I found interesting is the way that he made use of cultural not exactly artifacts, but details of where he found himself in North America in the early 1970s. And obviously he had studied at Oxford, and by the time he arrived here was quite fluent in English and had and very knowledgeable about a lot of the mythology and religious underpinnings of this of Western culture. And when I was reading this past week, I was rereading the Odyssey. It's one of my favorite stories, the Odyssey of Homer. And the first paragraph of the opening lines of the Odyssey of Homer say, Homer says, "Sing to me, Muse, of the man of many devices who wandered full many ways after he had sacked the sacred citadel of Troy. Many were the men whose cities he saw and whose mind he learned, aye, and many the woes he suffered in his heart upon the sea, seeking to win his own life and the return of his comrades." This beginning story, because I was thinking about this topic and about Chogyam Trungpa and about the topic of sacred world, when I read this, it resonated in my mind for a number of reasons. One of them was the very first words he says, "Sing to me, Muse," which is a very ancient Greek evocation or invocation of inspiration. And she is, it's a feminine, he's addressing a feminine, "Sing to me, Muse, tell me," which very early on, Chogyam Trungpa was talking about a quality of potentiality which he referred to as the feminine principle. I'm not sure if even to say that it was a quality of potentiality is an accurate way to say it. But very early on, he gave a seminar called The Feminine Principle, which you can now read. It's in one of the, I believe it's the collected works. I think it's in Volume 6. There's a fascinating series of talks that he gave called The Feminine Principle, in which he talks about this quality of empty space, feminine. And in Greek, they say, they ask the muse, they supplicate the muse, a feminine thing, and to actually open up the space. What can we say? We'll come back to that in a moment. In the next line of that, when it says, "Sing to me of the man of many devices." Also, the man of twists and turns. I thought, that sounds like somebody I've heard of. One of the qualities of Chogyam Trungpa was he was a man of many devices, and you could say a man of twists and turns. And he took many disguises and wore many strange outfits. And he did so in the same way that Odysseus does in the Odyssey. He does so with a very particular intent in mind that wasn't necessarily always discernible to anyone in the vicinity. But that was that. And then the other part of that is there are four parts, and this is the four opening lines of the Odyssey. The third one is, "Many were the men whose cities he saw and whose mind he learned," which also was one of the qualities of Chogyam Trungpa, that when he came, he already spoke English. He already was very familiar with so much of our culture. He already knew so much. And I remember encountering this quality when I was in my late 20s at the time, and reading, I believe, The Myth of Freedom was the first book of his that I read. And I thought, how can he know this about us? How can he know this so clearly? It's very interesting. "Many were the men whose cities he saw and whose mind he learned. And many the woes he suffered in his heart upon the sea, seeking to win his own life and the return of his comrades." And again, I think, a quality that if you study Tibetan Buddhism, the Kagyu lineage especially is heroic in its altruism. You know, just taking this information out to others, and saying, this is really important. This is really good. You should hear this, practice it, and know it, and realize it. And the extent to which some of the great Kagyu teachers have gone is exemplified by the life of Chogyam Trungpa. But I want to come back to this feminine principle idea again. Last week in his talk, Sherab Chudson referred to the gap, which he referred to as a, how did he say it? If maybe somebody remembers, it was something like an ongoing senior moment. And he was referring to the inability of the conceptual mind to hold together a completely plausible entity of any kind, and that it seems to fall apart, and that the term gap that Sherab Chudson was using last week was something that the Vidyadhara Chogyam Trungpa used a lot. He referred to as the gap, this sort of opening. And in another word that he used, that the Vidyadhara used frequently, was the word chaos. And he sometimes, he said famously, I actually don't know what the context of the original remark was, but you've probably heard the saying that chaos should be regarded as extremely good news. Well, chaos, if you go back to the original Greek word, a chaos literally means an open space or an opening. Or a gap. It's the root of the word chasm, and also the root of the word gas, when scientists were trying to describe matter in the 19th century. They went back to the word chaos because it meant something sort of open. It didn't seem to exist. So gas comes from the word chaos. The original Greek chaos is with a K, but the meaning is the same. It means an open space or an abyss or that which gapes wide open. Those are all meanings from the Greek word chaos. So when he was saying chaos should be regarded as extremely good news, I mean, we should know our own language, wouldn't you think? That if you go back to that, it's not just, I think most of us assumed he meant just something like pandemonium or just confusion should be regarded as good news, or things falling apart should be regarded as good news. But in fact, he was talking about something that precedes that, which is an opening, and it's things not holding together properly. Properly from our point of view, which is the senior moment. If we think about this this word in this context of a gap or an opening or chaos, or into thinking about it in terms of feminine principle, one of the things that Chogyam Trungpa said in talking about the feminine principle was he said he questioned whether it was possible to talk about something that does actually not exist in the sense of space. If we're talking about space or something that is that is not form, how can we possibly be talking about something that isn't there? And he went on to say that we can try, but interestingly the experience of space or potentiality in this way, or the muse, is non-conceptual, and so that it is not approachable or realizable by concepts. So how is it possible to understand or experience this? And what good is it anyway? I mean, what's the point? But there are a couple of interesting things that he did. One of them was I think it's called the Mudra Theater exercises. Barbara, do you know if it was the one where you intensify space and you is that the Mudra Theater exercises?
Yes.
Space awareness or Mudra Theater? Yeah. Okay. Some of you are familiar with this. Well, there's an interesting thing that he presented a number of extremely provocative exercises and very difficult. And this one, in my recollection, was one of the most difficult, where you would be on your knees on a hard floor and you would imagine, and there would be some kind of a ringleader who was running the whole thing in a group of people, and you would imagine that all the space around you was solid and that you yourself were space. And you're doing this while you're sitting on your knees, unpadded on a hard floor, which is very uncomfortable. So the posture is itself very physically demanding, and it goes on for a little bit, actually quite a bit longer than you'd like it to. And this, and someone is saying, okay, intensify, intensify. Isn't that the word that's used when someone's leading this? And that it ends up, it's almost like suddenly having the magnetic poles in your existence reversed, where you suddenly start, the space around you becomes so oppressively, it's like being encased in concrete, but you're at least an opening within there. It's a really sick exercise. There's another more gentle version of it that's sometimes familiar to visual artists, and actually Barbara Dilley, that's Barbara Dilley I'm referring to here, my colleague at Naropa, who I'm pretty happy to see here because I almost called you today about the five I practices. Because one of them is the seeing in between, seeing the spaces in between things. And this is something that you could actually try right now. When I was sitting beforehand, I thought, these rectangular openings between the railings here are actually ideal for this exercise. And what I recommend, if you're game right now, don't worry, you don't have to do anything and no one will see you, is to rest your eyes in the space, and just pick one that's kind of relaxed and comfortably in front of you, and rest your eyes right within the space that is defined by the orange railings. In a very relaxed way, just let your gaze relax into the space that is defined by the orange railings. If you try to conceptualize the space that's in there, it won't let you. You just see an opening between the railings. But if you relax your mind, it takes a couple of moments for this, and sometimes it does not work. But if you relax your mind, what starts to happen to the space in between is that it doesn't become a thing. At the same time, its shape becomes very apparent. And because its shape becomes apparent, it starts to take on something like presence, as if it almost is a thing, but it isn't, because it's just space. You can do this between any easily enclosed space, the rungs of chairs, the space between two people in front of you, the space between branches or leaves of a plant. It really, anything will work. If you relax your gaze and just rest your attention in the space between, this shift starts to happen. There are a couple of qualities of that shift that are worth talking about, and one of them is that it's not logical. It's not a logical shift. You can't say, well, yes, the space in between there became a solid thing that I could take away, or if you try to describe it exactly, it's very difficult because there isn't, you know, I mean, what happened? Did anything happen when you did that? Yes, no? No. I find that it takes some practice and relaxation and to do this in a visual arts context. Sometimes this is taught in very not in the context of feminine principle or space at all, but it's said that in drawing, that if you learn how to draw the spaces between things, you start to see the thing itself more clearly. So it has a very practical application in that field. But there's a further thing that I think is more metaphysical in the experience of drawing the space between things or seeing the space between things. And that is that it can bring the mind to a threshold of nonsense. It's literally nonsense, because it doesn't make sense to look at the space in between, or we're so accustomed to looking at the form of things. But if we start reversing that and looking at the space in between things, this wonderful kind of confusion, in a positive sense of the word, happens, which becomes a kind of reversal. In there's another word that Chögyam Trungpa used that is... let me back up a second. I find that when in my drawing classes at Naropa, when I have students draw in between, they're game. They can go there. They'll do it for a while. But after a while, they don't want to anymore, and which I find very curious. And I'll say, why don't you want to do that anymore? And I mean, part of it is just, you know, it's boring. But... but there is this other deep thing that I believe is that, and this is very much our own experience of ourselves. If we say we practice meditation and we sit, and usually we have a lot of thoughts going on, but if we're not thinking, if we're not cooking something up, or we're not, if we're not sort of entertaining ourselves, as the Vidyadhara used to say. It seems like, what's the point? Which is, I think, what makes meditation so difficult. You know, because in a very real way, what we are encountering is nothing. You know, we're encountering a non-ego or nothing whatsoever, which is probably the least interesting thing to ourselves that we could possibly come up with, because it's so not about us. So there is another word that is Chögyam Trungpa used in certain very interesting occasions. He used the word panic. He would say, "Don't panic." That would be something that some of you may have heard him say or you read. He'd say, "Don't panic." And there's another word that, if you trace back to the Greek origin, that it comes from panikos or panikon, which referred to the god Pan, and it was it was referring to a specific thing that happens to herds of animals where they just suddenly freak out for no apparent reason. They just freak out and they stampede. You know, it's not even necessarily lightning or anything at all. They just, something spooks them and off they go. So the word panic comes from that. It's sort of like said to be this something unseen and actually unfounded that throws the animals into a panic. If you think about that in relation to our own relationship to space, for example, and part of why we get so busy with ourselves and why our minds are so busy is that we're basically panicked. And so we're stampeding. And the ego is our own personal stampede going on. We're just freaked and we're stampeding, and we don't even know why. Panic. It's also said in the original Greek word that the panic is contagious. So that, you know, it's like, I see you running, I'm running, we're all running. We're all in it together. And it also means literally a fear of nothing. Which is so interesting if you think about it in terms of the possibility of there being form and space, that what we're afraid of is space. We're afraid of nothing, and so we stampede. And that is one description of many possibilities of how we solidify this character, the ego. It's trying to put together something to fend off something that isn't even there. There's a very interesting description, obviously there are a lot of very interesting descriptions in the meditation instructions about how to approach the mind. And one of them is very, very simple, and it describes the experience of mind as two things. mental operations and awareness. And so that there is, you know, the mental operations are what we are all very familiar with is the, you know, it's the sense perceptions, the thought process, and so on. And the awareness is continuously functioning. It's, you know, it's autonomic in the sense that it doesn't, we don't have to set it in motion. We don't have to set awareness up. You know, it is autonomic the way digestion and so on is autonomic. Self-ruling, it literally means autonomic. And if we think about the process of, say, panic and stampede in relation to this, mental operations and awareness. One way of experiencing the mind is that, and this is probably a familiar experience to anyone who's meditated for more than 5 or 10 minutes, is that there is, on the one hand, a tremendous amount of a very obvious mental operation going on. I mean, it's really obvious, isn't it? We think, we've got our memories, we hear sounds. It's all going on, and somehow or other, we at least perfunctorily, label it all thinking and return our attention to the breath. But the mental operations part generally gets the most of the floor. You know, it gets most of the airtime, you could say. And the awareness, which is going along, is simultaneously aware, obviously, but also untouched. It's not affected. It's not polluted or stained or bothered in any way. So, by the way, this model of mind, like many of the models of mind in Buddhism, is not. You know, solid or real or anatomically dissectable, but they're useful because if you think about meditation for a moment and that we have this tremendous amount of mental contents or what was the word I said? Operations, thank you. Mental operations going on, that it's possible, and when that the mental operation, especially when it's kind of out of hand, when we recognize the exact moment that we recognize that our attention has gotten out of hand, not our attention, but the operation has gotten out of hand, we say thinking. And as has been said in many other contexts, if we're looking very closely, way before we even say thinking, there was already an awareness that we were off. And the thinking is almost Neanderthal. I mean, saying the word thinking almost is, kind of clubbing it at that point, because we've already figured it out. This model of mental operations and awareness is a really good way to understand how meditation practice works, because it gives us a choice that we can, when we find ourselves having wandered way off and on a discursive fantasy of some kind, usually what we do is go with the content of what we've just noticed. That's our allegiance, just out of habit, is to go with the content of what we just noticed. There's a very easily said, a shift of allegiance, and that is a word that Chogyam Trungpa used a lot, was allegiance. You shift the allegiance to the, in this case, the awareness. You just shift to the awareness. Or another way of saying it is that instead of going with the content, you go with the recognition. Which is another way of saying that instead of going with the form, you go with the space. That instead of giving or reifying the apparent content of our minds and our sense perceptions, we rest right within the awareness itself, or the recognition itself. And that can happen right in the moment, just like that. And in fact, already does happen, already is happening, which is why meditation works. Because it's not adding some other thing to it. It's actually seeing the layout of what is. (Clears there's a part of this also that I wanted to say just a couple of words about, and that is the in artistic practice, there's a wonderful video by a contemporary artist named David Hockney, and the video is called something like, it's a long title, it's something like A Day on the Grand Canal with the Emperor of China. And it's a wonderful tour of a scroll. And in this video, David Hockney talks about different ways of depicting space. That and he contrasts this scroll, which uses a system of Chinese perspective that actually allows viewers to see multiple sides of the same thing. That when you see a Chinese scroll, that there are examples, and he points them out. It's a very beautiful video. You can get it at Video Station. It's also in the Naropa Library. That you can see several sides of the same building simultaneously. This system is so ingenious that it doesn't force you to look only in a way, in the manner of Western perspective. And he compares that scroll to a Canaletto painting, a famous Renaissance painter who had a lot to do with perfecting what we call perspective. And for those of you who might not be familiar, the simplest example of perspective is, you know, when you see a photograph or a painting and all of the lines sort of converge backward to a point. And the most famous example is a set of railroad tracks. And you see the railroad tracks and they go off and they converge at the horizon. Can you picture it? That system of depicting space evolved in the European Renaissance, and that it has to do with the way optics work, and that the converging of lines has to do with how light is bent by the lens of the eye, and so on and so forth. And it's an ingenious system. It's really, really ingenious. But it's false from the point of view is that, you know, I see John over there, and I know that John is taller than my thumb. But right now, he and my thumb are the same height. So if I believe in that system of depiction of space, I could be in trouble because I might think that John is only, you know, 3 inches tall. But there's a further thing that David Hockney goes on to say in this video, and that is that if you picture space, and go back to the railroad track image again, and he draws a little diagram in the movie, and he draws the lines converging back to the horizon, and it's called a vanishing point on the horizon, that he said, if we say that is infinity and that the viewer is back here, if we depict space in this manner, and if infinity is God, then the viewer and God will never meet. It's an ingenious insight into a very deeply rooted cultural dilemma that we in the West have, that somehow the way that we depict space actually separates us out from it. And that's a deeply ingrained cultural habit in the West, that we depict space as vanishing off out there rather than that it is something that is around us. And he goes on to say something quite profound, and that is that, let me back up one second. He said that it was this triangulation, or the understanding of perspective and space, that actually enabled cannons to be aimed more precisely, which suddenly created a huge technological advantage in warfare. And lots of problems that came in the following centuries. And he goes on to say that the way that we depict space has everything to do with how we behave in it. Which is a very amazing thing that brings us back to this conversation of what is this space that we're in at any moment? You know, how do we conceive of this space? Are we separate from it? Or is it in us or around us, or is it not, does it not exist at all? Is it not even relevant? One of the things that Chögyam Trungpa did, one of the very curious things that when I was an earlier student, that he was in the process of introducing was many different aspects of decorum, of how we should dress, how we should speak, how we should move in a space. If we're serving food to other people, how is that done? If we are being served food by other people, how are we to receive that? And he introduced many different ways of practicing this. Some of them, some of you may remember, were exceedingly tedious. But I believe what he was talking about was instructing us about how to behave in space, how literally to behave in space, that when you walk into a room, how do you walk into a room? How are you dressed? How do you speak? How do you pick up a fork? All of those details have to do with our relationship to the space, that it's a movement through space, being within space, being embraced by space. Back to Homer for a moment. In the Greek world, there was some really well-known and well-studied customs in the world that lasted for about a millennium, and that was hospitality to strangers. That when people would arrive, there was a very definite set of rituals of how a stranger was welcomed. And it was a welcome that in the Homer Odyssey of Homer, some of the welcomings make you laugh out loud. You know, imagine showing up unannounced at a wedding feast. No one knows who you are. They take off your clothes and they bathe you and oil you and put fresh clothes on you and give you a seat of honor at the table with, fresh fleeces wrapped around you. And they give you the best cuts of meat and a big bowl of wine. And they wait until you're all done eating before they ask you who you are. they make you laugh out loud. You think, wow. I mean, the Greeks, you know, were really they made a lot of war. They were very, very violent at the same time, but they had this this thing about welcoming strangers that's very interesting. And if you think about that in terms of both literally as a matter of decorum of how we greet one another, but also metaphorically of how do we greet what is unfamiliar? How does what come to us, how do we greet it? It's a very interesting thing to contemplate. Usually when anything comes up where we're not necessarily... can you imagine having a total stranger just having come into your house and, you know, here's the shower, here's some clean towels, you know, come on downstairs. I mean, it's hard to imagine in our time doing that. But metaphorically, it's also hard sometimes to imagine just an entirely new experience coming to our mind or an idea and welcoming it, bathing it, oiling it, and feeding it. And then saying, who are you? Which I think is connected to the idea of friendliness, you know, in the sense of Maitri, Maitri Bhavana, that is the idea, that it's all unfamiliar. All of what's happening is unprecedented, literally unprecedented. It has not happened before. This has not happened before. So how do we greet it? You know, what is our mind? Are we too busy? Is it, you know, what is, how do we greet it? That's mostly what I want to say. There's one other thing that I did want to say, and that is another theme that I notice in the Vidyadhara's life and also in his lineage, and I think it may be universal, and that is the theme of leaving, departing, being separated, going away. And that if you read Chögyam Trungpa's life story, you know, the details are probably well known to many of you, that he did have to leave his monastery, and he had to leave his country, and then he had to leave India, and when he left India for England, he had to leave England, and he had to leave his monastic discipline or I'm not sure if that's the right way to say it. You know, he decided not to be a monk. And that throughout his life and in many of the lineage holders' lives, that the theme of leaving is very common. In the historical Mahapandita Naropa's life, his story is also one of having to leave behind. And if you read his life story, it's having to leave behind what in some cases seemed like good situations. He had to be, he had to go somewhere else. And I think about that when Peter and Clark asked me to give a talk in this class. I think a lot among the students around who are older students of Chogyam Trungpa. And, you know, what do we do with ourselves? And where are we? And what's the, you know, what do we do? What do we do? And I think some people are quite fine, and many are not, very uncertain, you know, almost like in a holding pattern. What are we supposed to do? And I was thinking that the process of meeting a great teacher, and then the teacher dies, and the students grow up, and there's going to be a kind of dispersion that goes on that in some ways is very natural. In the manner of plants growing through a cycle, and they have a flowering, and then there's a pollination, and then there are seeds. And it's actually kind of strange for the seeds to want to hang around the plant continuously. You know, there has to be some further thing. And I think we are, in some ways, historically at that point as a Sangha, for the older students especially. You know, there is some way in which we need to leave, and I'm not sure what it is that we have to leave, and I suspect it's different for each of us. And I think it might be a frame of mind. For some people that I know, it's a matter of leaving behind a frame of mind of things not being the same as they used to be, which is the, you could say, the law of the universe. They're just not. They never will be. When I was preparing for this, I ran across this exchange between Chogyam Trungpa and a student, and it was during his parting comments at the 1981 Vajradhatu Seminary. And a student says, "Sir, what would you recommend as the best antidote for periods of very low inspiration or motivation for practice?" Rinpoche, "What do you think is going to inspire you to higher inspiration?" Student, "You, hopefully." Rinpoche, "Who am I? I'm not going to be with you." Student, "Well, you are present to us in the sense of maintaining the ongoing Sangha situation." Rinpoche, "Yes, but what is my residue in you?" Student, "The things you've said here and the teachings you've shared with us." Rinpoche, "Precisely. You yourself have to become Sangha. You are part of me in that sense. We are one in that sense. You are no longer Joe Schmidt. I am no longer Chogyam Trungpa. We are no longer two foreign entities trying to fit together. We have connections already. We are trying to stick together. Therefore, we always have a connection. My residue is with you always." I don't know if anyone has any comments or questions or additions or subtractions, as one of the translators once said.
Bob, excuse me, you were talking about a choice when you noticed the intense operations. And you talked about it, one way of looking at it was form or emptiness, and that you choose, not necessarily emptiness, but, well, did you say emptiness? You didn't say emptiness. Form or awareness?
Yeah.
Yeah. But you could, but the opposing pair of, the opposing other of that pair was form. Awareness and form.
Yeah.
My question there is, if the Heart Sutra is onto something, what's the distinction
between
form and awareness?
Yeah. I think maybe that comment that I said was preceded by a lot that might have made that comment make more sense.
Okay, I'm sorry. I came in sort of in the middle of it.
Yeah, but one of the things that I was careful to point out was that to say that there is mental operations and awareness could lead to the conclusion that those are two completely separate entities, and in fact they can't be. You know, you can't see the cushion, be aware of the seeing of the cushion without the cushion. You know, I mean, they're not separatable. But there is an allegiance, and that is, I believe, the word that the Vidyadhara used was allegiance, which is a very interesting word. I should have looked that one up, too. I love to look up words and see where they go back, because they often reveal secrets. But the allegiance is, you know, you don't even have to move. Do you know what I mean? I can shift my allegiance without even moving. So it's kind of an interesting word to use.
Yeah, it's very subtle.
Yeah.
Shift or activity.
I think the other thing about the awareness quality, and that I think it's what scares us and what panics us in the Greek sense of the word and what causes us to stampede, is that it's so bright. You know, the quality of actually seeing without, interpretation or opinion, that seeing in a way that in some ways is completely impersonal, is terrifying. Even though nothing could be more personal from some point of view.
Something I've been trying to discover is, well, it seems like that it's a very black and white, at least on the relative level, between... Are you saying operations or operations?
Operations, like
operations.
Yeah.
I thought that, like, operations was a word for, like, confused mind manifesting. But anyway...
No, just plain old operations.
Operations. So you weren't distinguishing between discursive mind and awareness?
But that could be one of the things. But mental operations is a neutral term, you know, in the sense that it's just, you know, the operations of the mind, you know, the sense perceptions, the it includes discursive thoughts, you know, the whole thing.
Okay, forget it. But in terms of confused mind and awareness, just looking at it from that perspective,
okay,
that's very black and white on a certain relative level, that it seems for me that I'm either, my allegiance is either to one or the other in terms of either being aware or being distracted.
Mm-hmm.
You think, is that true, or is there a middle ground?
Yeah, I'm not sure. The first part of your question confused me slightly. It's not so much an allegiance between the mental operations isn't necessarily confused mind. It's just the mind working, and that in some ways, you know, and this is where these kinds of mental models can get us into trouble, because you start picking them apart slightly. There is just this. There is this thing that somehow the mind does its thing, and that there is a quality of awareness that underlies the whole thing, or pervades the whole thing, you could say, is maybe a better word. It just pervades the whole thing. So it's not so much that you can go from one thing to the other exactly. That's where this sort of shift of allegiance is maybe a better way to say it. That we're not really going anywhere or returning from anything. Like when we come back from a discursive thought, you know, there's the famous Mahamudra questions about, well, did the mind go anywhere? You know, like I was just in Bermuda a few minutes ago. You know, was I in Bermuda? Well, no. Where was the mind? Did it go anywhere? You know, in that line of questioning. And you can only conclude that there was no... nothing went anywhere.
But you were in Bermuda there for a little while.
I think I sure was. Yeah. I think another way that it's described that I find helpful is that there is a simultaneity. Do you know that the Bermudaness and the awakeness are going on at the same time, and that we can and this is where the allegiance happens again. I can have my allegiance to the Bermudaness or the sort of the awakeness without the judgment that Bermuda is bad and awake is good. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of, as Peter was suggesting, it's very subtle. It's like, you know, the mind. There's another term that some of Kenpo Sultrum Gyamso's translators use that I find very helpful, and they refer to the action of the mind as mind's resource. It's mind's resource. It's not mind's problem, you know. It's mind's resource, and so that the Bermudaness and the whole thing is the natural functioning of a rich mind.
And that understanding requires a level of awareness occurring.
I think so. Yeah.
So if you have that level of awareness, then there is a middle ground. But if you don't have that level of awareness, then you're either in Bermuda or in your aggression, or not, or aware.
Yeah, that's the way I experience it, and that's why I keep meditating, because I can't claim to sort of rest in complete equanimity with the whole thing. I find that if I don't sit, it's pretty much like not brushing my teeth. You know, I can get by a day. Second day gets kind of gross, and the third day I'm in serious trouble.
Thanks.
Yeah. There's another that reminded me of a story that I heard one time, and in the very early days in Vermont, at the what was then called Tail of the Tiger, there were a group of students sitting around, and they were discussing meditation practice. And one of the students said, "I am a composer and I write music. And when I get very inspired and excited about writing music, I start getting ideas and musical themes come into my mind, and then they start multiplying and they become more elaborate, and then pretty soon all I can do, whether I'm walking, sitting, or doing anything, is just have these huge musical movements going through my mind. What can I do?" And Drungpa Rinpoche looked at him and said, "That sounds fantastic." I mean, as an artist, I love that story, because he wasn't saying, "Oh, you shouldn't have musical themes going through your head." He was saying that is the mind. That is mind's resource. It's mind's richness, and it's so astonishing. But I think what you're driving at is a really good thing to remember, that it's that there is a discipline involved with learning how to separate out what is just a habitual way of experiencing the mind, and what's something much more open. And I believe that's what the feminine principle, the idea of space, or there being nothing, as a possibility, is really intriguing and a little scary.
My question has to do with what constitutes sacredness of reality. And I was reading a book by Reggie Ray, and he talked about, if I understood him correctly, that part of what constitutes the sacredness of reality is the existence of many kinds of beings throughout the six realms. And he said that many people talk about that in the sense of just being a manifestation of your own mind. But he says that if you stop there, you're leaving out the important part, that those beings really do exist. But then he sort of qualifies it and says, from an ultimate point of view, everything is just a manifestation of mind. But from a relative point of view, they really do exist, like you exist and this Gandhan exists. And I was wondering if you thought Chogyam Trungpa viewed that, would agree with that.
I can't imagine thinking that I would be able to know what he thought.
Well, I mean, based on his writings.
Yeah.
I haven't read everything. But
one of the things that I found about him that really helpful was that, specifically with the Six Realms, for example, was that he, in almost every context, chose to present those in a way that was pragmatic and psychological. You know, this is what a hell realm actually likes, and it feels like, and you know it, and I know it, and, you know, you've been there, I've been there. This is what a God realm feels like. You know, that kind of instruction, I found that to be most helpful, because it was non-speculative. You know, it's not a matter of speculation of that maybe there are places down under the basement with flames and screaming people and, you know, so on. That who knows, and how do you prove it, and who's the final referee? Where, to bring it into the realm of experience, I find, was one of the things about Chogyam Trungpa's instruction that I found extremely helpful. Do you know what I mean by non-speculative? You know, I don't know. You know, I would only be speculating. I love the thought that there are these things around in the Odyssey that, I mean, they're all over the place. Right. You know, Athena shows up and the things that she does, you know, she just suddenly, she's like Mystique in the X-Men. You know, she just shows up in some form and does things.
Well, let me put it a little differently then. There are some places in Chogyam Trungpa where I get the feeling that he sees this more as a manifestation of mind. When someone, I think, asked him what happens after death, and he just shrugged his shoulders. But at other times, I sense that he does have a faith in these other kinds of beings in a different kind of world from a certain perspective.
Yeah.
Is that your sense?
Yeah. I don't know how to answer that, only because I haven't, you know, I never had the opportunity to hear him talk about it or... but one thing does come to mind. He gave a seminar sometime in the around the mid 1970s, and it was, I think it was called Devotion and Prayer in the Buddha Dharma or something like that. I don't know if anybody remembers that seminar, but he talked specifically about what does it mean to supplicate, you know, the lineage, you know, and people who've been dead for 1,000 years. What does that mean? And one of the comments he made was, he said, you know, when I supplicate them, he said, they're just like right in the room with me. He said, but on the other hand, I'm a true believer. That's a very close paraphrase of what he said.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Robert, when you were asking us to perform this exercise of scene, frame, space, I looked up at the Vajradhara Tanka here and remembered for a moment that the color of Vajradhara being blue is because the quality of the awakened mind is vast like the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And I just took that perspective, and it seemed to flip around almost immediately, in which, rather than trying to figure out who Vajradhara is, it's that space has a very distinct expression. It is adorned, such as Vajradhara, and it conveys something there. And in that regard, I was remembering, as I was just reading the last few days, the Feminine Principle seminar, in which Vajradhara talks about the Feminine Principle also having expression. And that expression is inseparable from the feminine principle, but it is expression, and that's the masculine principle. So the masculine principle is the texture and the brilliance of what our awareness encounters, including itself. So it's color, it's sound, it's the senses, it's the unleashed quality of our awareness and our senses. So I'm wondering, as an artist, rather than, of course, it's very valuable to experience the space, but do you think you can have the same results, so to speak, by just zeroing in on the intensity of color, zeroing in on the claustrophobia of the senses in such a way that you don't hesitate in order to find the space, but you find within that experience that the space exists as expression?
Yes. Yeah.
You flip your perspective, and then you go with what's happening.
Yeah, but remember that all perception is happening in space. Do you know what I mean? I mean, like, it's right now. We are in space right now. I mean, literally, you know, you could say the space is defined by the walls in this room, but we are in a space right now. So, you know, the one example that comes to mind is the Impressionist painters in the late 1800s were, I believe, occupying, in the best sense of the word, or inhabiting, maybe is a better word, the space that they were painting in. And the reason why those paintings are so vivid is because of that. Because of all the reasons you're saying, is that out of the space was coming the movement and the color and the wind and the snapping flag and all of it was because of the very thing you're saying. So it's not so much a matter of intensifying the form as much as inhabiting the space.
Could you say that you're allowing space to express itself with its own intensity?
When it's the best, that's what happens. But most of the time, we're doing something else. I mean, I'm speaking for myself as an artist. I'm doing something else, and that is I'm taking up space rather than inhabiting space, and which makes artistic practice so embarrassing.
Thank you.
Yeah. There's one other thing that Clark was bringing up that's worth mentioning, too, and it comes from that same seminar, is that if we think of space as feminine, and this, again, is a crossover with the Greek idea of chaos and feminine principle, and that open space, is that the goddesses made themselves visible by putting on adornments, and that the word cosmetic that we come comes from the word cosmos, which is in some places it's a dyad with chaos. Chaos and cosmos are the there's the open space, and then there is the creation of something, and that the word cosmetic literally comes from that. And the famous Anne Waldman poem, "Putting Makeup on Empty Space," comes right out of that. You know, that's what if you ever go back, and if you've ever had the opportunity to hear her, you can go on YouTube, I think. Go to YouTube and say Anne Waldman, "Makeup on Empty Space," and brace yourself if you haven't heard her do it before. But it's brilliant, and she's talking about this very thing.
Yeah. I just wanted to point out, too, that I was just reading the other night that the word crisis is from the Greek word to decide.
Really?
Yes.
Cool. Isn't it great knowing these things? I mean, it's almost like discovering a secret code. You know, they're words we use all the time, and you know, you realize they're ancient, and they're actually talking about something quite deep. Excuse me. Yeah.
I found your discussion of the welcoming of strangers to be amusing. And earlier in your talk, you mentioned that I think a manifestation of a culture can contain the wisdom of culture. And I had the experience in being in India for some time to receive that welcome as a stranger and feel kind of the amazing openness that kind of genuine welcoming created. And a lot of the things that you have said this evening kind of seem to be reflected by that image, both your example of looking into space seems kind of similar to that in this culture, in the Indian culture, they're kind of giving you space to be without defining you. And that this idea perhaps even encourages the people of that culture to allow moments of spaciousness without expectation and without definition, to allow the muse to inspire space.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I think that's the idea, you know. Wouldn't that be great if we behaved that way? In traffic? Thank you.
How do you relate energy to space and form?
I think Clark has the answer to that. No, I think that's what Clark was... So I think you were driving at. How do you relate energy to space? You know, that there is this potentiality, you know, and then it something arises from that, and it's... Between space and form? I don't know. It's tricky to try to pick this apart too conceptually because it doesn't seem to work. It just doesn't seem to work. You know, there's a analogy that's used in mystical Islam that the intellect is extremely important. And the saying is that if you want to meet God, this is in Islam, if you want to meet God, you can ride the intellect all the way to the castle where God lives. But if you want to actually meet God, you have to get off of the horse of intellect to go in. You can't ride the horse in. It's a beautiful image for, at a certain point, we can, with our conceptual minds, be brought right to the door of something. But if we want to experience it, we have to... Something else has to happen. Literally, the term threshold or a liminal experience, you know, a limna is a threshold, and that the sometimes this is used in a lot of different cultures. There are descriptions of how do you cross from, just habitual mind or just kind of habitual perception into something that's not hobbled by that. And frequently, one of the first things that has to go is the conceptual mind. It's very interesting. You know, the concept, the rigid logical mind has to be somehow put to sleep. When my wife and I used to run Dorje Kyungzong, the retreat center in southern Colorado, and somebody tacked a cartoon to the wall in the shower house, and it was of a man... sprawled on the couch with a huge lump on his head and a hammer in his limp hand. And the caption was, "Simon puts a stop to his critical inner dialogue." Anyway, maybe we should stop. Oh, and one more question here.
Yeah, this may be more of a comment, but maybe I'll ask if you agree or not, or see it differently. Getting back to the question of energy, what came to mind for me is that your very first, whatever you pick up on in the very first instant, whether it's in a new encounter with a person, a place, a thing, before all the thoughts come crowding in, is the energy. And it's really right on. And then after that, all kinds of other things start crowding in, and you start pigeonholing and applying what you know from the past, which is useful sometimes, mm-hmm. You know. But is that what... Do you agree with that, the energy thing is, what that is, what I'm trying to describe?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if I would limit it to the sort of the first take, but it sounds good.
Well, I think it maybe applies to if you're of sound mind. I mean, if you're not like clinically paranoid or something, that your first impression or the thing that is there first before mm-hmm. everything else.
Yeah, isn't Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book about this? A couple years ago, called Blink, and he talks about this, about the very first intuitive flash of many, many situations, so frequently turns out to have been the correct one, even though you did all kinds of research and decided otherwise later. It was that very first one that was the one that that got you. It also reminded me of something that Maya Angelou said. She said, people will forget everything you said, most of what you've done, but they'll always remember how you made them feel. Which is a very powerful statement. And getting back to the hospitality, you know, I mean, we should really be bathing and oiling each other down every time we meet. Yeah. Maybe we should stop there. I forgot to bow at the beginning, so will one bow count for the whole thing? Thank you. Thanks for coming out on such a horrible night, too.